Now, this morning, I want to talk to you on the subject of discipline, chore or challenge. There are two yeasty passages which I would like to knead into your thinking. The first of these is found in 1 Samuel chapter 3. When I was a boy in Sunday school, they used to tell the story of Samuel in the temple. He would awaken in the night, having heard a voice, and he'd go into Eli's quarters, the high priest, and say, "Did you call me?" He said, "No, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep." This happened three times, until finally the spiritual dullard got the message. And he said, "The next time you hear that voice, respond by saying, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.'" And that's where the story ended. And it used to bug me as a kid, because I used to wonder, I wonder what he said. Well, I'm going to tell you what he said, and then you'll find out why it didn't come in a Sunday school lesson. Found in 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 12. God is speaking, and he said, "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house, from the beginning even unto the end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever." Now mark the reason. "For the iniquity which he knew." His problem was not a problem of ignorance. It was a problem of indifference. He knew, but he chose not to do anything. "Because his sons did bring a curse upon themselves, and he restrained them not." Now mark it well. Eli was a dedicated priest, but he was a defective parent. Far as I can study the narrative, he was not a bad man. I think he was probably too busy in the service of the Lord. That's possible, you know. If you're too busy for your family, you're busier than God intended you to be. And this passage tells me something from which I cannot escape. It tells me that it is possible for an individual to be professionally successful and parentally a failure. And no amount of business or professional or homemaking success will in any way compensate for parental failure. So God scores this man, not for their action, but for his apathy. Not for what his kids did, but for what he failed to do. Now, turn over to a second passage in the New Testament. It's in the book of Ephesians. You will find yourself in your Christian life returning to the Ephesians drawing board on many occasions. This is a critical and determinative portion of the Word. And in Ephesians chapter 5, you have a series of relationships. Relationships that create responsibilities. Relationships between the husband and the wife, between the wife and the husband, between parents and children, and between children and parents. Relationships always create responsibility. In chapter 6 and verse 4, you have a remarkable verse of Scripture. "And ye fathers." Please note, gentlemen, this is addressed to you. Not because discipline is your exclusive role. Nothing could be worse than saying to a child, "You wait till your father comes home." You know, what a great expectation. Hardly wait for Pop to arrive. This is addressed to fathers because the father is the responsible member in the family under God. This does not mean he will do all of the discipline, but that he is responsible for all of the discipline which is either done or not done. You can never palm this off on your wife, gentlemen, by saying, "The woman thou gavest me." That's how we got into this rhubarb in the first place. God someday will ask you to give an account of your stewardship as a father. That's going to be an interesting experience. Tell me what you did. "Well, Lord, you remember that tremendous business deal we put together?" "Thank you, I'm well informed of it." What did you do with your family?" "Well, Lord, you know, I did become an elder down there at the church and led the Sunday school program." "Thank you very much. I appreciate the information." Back to the issue. What did you do with the wife and the children that I gave you? See, that's a sobering responsibility. It's a tremendous privilege. But it's a rather exacting responsibility. Now, the next expression is highly instructive in the Greek text, and I don't want to regale you with a lot of stuff that you're not interested in, but this verbal expression can be translated in one of two ways, and in either way, it throws a great deal of light upon the passage. Your passage probably says, "Provoke not your children to wrath." This can be translated, "Stop provoking your children to wrath." Or, it can be translated, "Don't get the habit." In other words, if you're doing it, cut it out. If you're not doing it, never get started. It's addictive. And it's amazing how easy it is to provoke your children to wrath. You can do this in a number of ways, but I think one of the easiest ways is to be guilty of arbitrary discipline. Why? "Oh, don't ask any questions. Sit down." And of course, you know, you can force the child to do anything you're capable of following through on. And I see it all the time, you know, "Sit down, son." "Yeah." "Sit down." "Yeah." You know, Pop rushes over and boom! Push him down the chair. "Now you will sit down." He smiles. He said, "I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside." Because you see, the whole process of discipline is developing inner control. Developing a child into a self-starter. They have all kinds of students who do anything you tell them to do, as long as you got a 45 in their head. "You love to read this book, don't you?" "I love to read this book." But see, what you are trying to do is to develop a person who is going to read, who's going to study, who's going to work, who's going to act responsibly the rest of his life when you're not there. You're trying to build inner control. And a lot of parents think their primary role is lid-sitting. So they spend all of their time sitting on a lid, and they pile bricks on it. But you see, someday you got to take your hand off that lid. And it's my experience, the harder you hold that lid down, the higher it's going to go when you take your hand off. I remember as a student at Wheaton College, I used to spend an awful lot of my time as a freshman in Wheaton going into the city of Chicago to pull kids off of State Street. Because they come out of some ultra-protective type of home where all of the decisions were made for them, where they were ultra-protected. No inter-controls built in. And man, when they got 500, 1,000 miles away from home, boy, they kicked over the traces. So he says, "Stop provoking your children to wrath." Now, it's a manifest fact that we are creatures of extremes. We are always suffering from what I call the peril of the pendulum. Whenever you react, you are in danger of setting up another extreme. One extreme is over-discipline. That is, in which a parent conceives of his role as that of a Simon Legree. Every time the kid turns around, they're nailing him to the floor. Cut it out! Stop it! Shut up! You know, the kid's 12 before he learns his name is not shut up. I was out with the juvenile department one night. We picked up a kid who had been beaten into unconsciousness by his father. And when we finally contacted his dad, the first thing he wanted to assure us was he was a disciplinarian. The officer and I counted 64 major welts on that kid's body. Truth of the matter is, his father didn't have a clue as to what discipline was all about. He thought discipline was punishment. It's not. You know what it is? It's discipleship. Hey, that's the N word, isn't it? We just invented that one. Discipleship, man, you know, that's what we're doing. What is it? I don't know, but that's what we're doing. I had one, but the wheels fell off. Whatever they are, you got to have one. And I find people going all over the world looking for a ministry of discipleship. And they're neglecting the most important disciples in their whole life, their children. I'll never forget somebody at the seminary asking my wife one day, Miss Hendricks, are you into discipleship? I said, yeah, a little bit. Oh, really? How many do you have? Four. Just four? Right. Barb, Bob, Bev, Bill. You mean you don't teach home Bible? No, I don't. I spend most of my time discipling my four. Is that all right? And you know, the interesting thing is, you can turn all kinds of people on, except your own kids. Having you known internationally as a disciple maker, you know, the real test is, you know, what are you doing at home? And you don't work in discipleship very long before you realize that discipleship is not punishment. It's not running around with a great big club, knocking everybody over the head. It's a process of developing an individual to become all that he's capable to become in Jesus Christ. What an exciting assignment. Well, then we react to this, and we go to the other side, and we're guilty of under-discipline. Permissivism. Oh, don't touch Johnny. You'll destroy his psyche. Johnny wants to throw a brick through a plate glass window. Don't stop him. You'll curb his genius for throwing bricks. Always remember somebody asking Grady Wilson, did your mother ever spank you? He said, did she ever spank me? She had a strap that hung underneath the motto, I need thee every hour. And you know, the amazing thing is this, my friend. You know, the longer I'm in this business, some of us were chatting about this morning and also last night. You know, the longer I'm in this thing, the more I realize that after we've done all of our research and all of our study and get rid of the garbage and come back to reality, we say, this is what we have learned. And I say, right, that's exactly what it says. And this is a case in point. Because if you've studied or read in the field of psychology, you constantly come back to the fact that you can go down to juvenile hall in the state of California and you will find the majority of people who are there come from one of two extremes in their family. They were either over-disciplined or they were under-disciplined. What the Scripture says is, stop provoking your children to wrath by over-discipline or under-discipline. But, the Scripture says, bring them up. How? Well, he uses two interesting words, in the nurturing and in the chastening of the Lord. The first of these is positive. The second of these is negative. And you need both kinds. Let me see if I can illustrate this for you. Let's draw ourselves a square. And in the center of it, let's put a huge circle. Every good physician practices two forms of medicine. He practices preventive medicine and he practices corrective medicine. And every good parent practices two forms of discipline. He practices preventive discipline and he practices corrective discipline. What's the relationship? Just this. The effectiveness of corrective discipline is always determined by the effectiveness of preventive discipline. Corrective discipline always has a context. Let me illustrate. You play with your child? See, I say to a parent, if you don't play with your child, you have no right to spank him. Oh, you say, I certainly do. I'm his parent. I can do what I want. Yeah, you can. But you can't guarantee the result. I love to work with university students who are off on some freedom kick. Hey, you know, Hendrix, don't hang that thing on me, man. I'm free. Great. Welcome to the club. I love to explain this illustration when I'm in a building, at least on the seventh story or above. Because I say, certainly you're free. In fact, you're free to jump out the window. Be my guest. But once you're out the window, you're no longer free. You're going down. It's a law. It's called the law of gravitation. It's going to dash you in pieces on the concrete below. So I don't like that law. The law is never offended. So I don't understand how that law works. The law couldn't care less. When you're out, it'll take over. By the time you hit the bottom, you will have instruction. See, my friends, you are free to choose, but you are not free to escape the consequences. And that's especially true in parenting. See, there are all kinds of options open to you. You're free. But you are not free to escape the consequences. There is a product that you are in the process of producing. Now, by the way, don't get covered over with guilt on that. Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. I can see you're already into it. The next question I ask is, do you listen to your child? Notice I didn't ask, do you talk to him? I know the answer to that. What I'm asking you is, when is the last time you took a walk with your kid and kept your mouth shut? You know, just listen. Fix your boy's bicycle tire, little girl's doll buggy, dollhouse, what have you. Had a beautiful experience recently working with a delinquent. His father has come to Christ, and man, it's just beautiful to watch what happens. And this kid just can't believe it. He hasn't come to faith yet, but he's en route. But he's just blown his mind, see the changes. He came in to me, I said, how you coming, man? Oh, man, great. I can't believe my dad. I said, really, what happened? He said, well, you believe I came home the other night after the curfew, because I couldn't help it. And he said, my father didn't blow his cork. I said, really? That's kind of miraculous, isn't it? You better believe it. You know what happened? His kid was out with his mom, and a transmission fell out on the highway. About two blocks from home. And he said, good night. I'll never make the curfew. So his buddies pushed it 2 miles. and pushed the baby into the garage. And he felt, good night, I'm over the curfew. I got to go tell my father. So he comes and he gingerly wakes him. He says, hey, Dad, I'm sorry, I'm late. Father said, well, what's the matter, son? I said, the transmission went out. He said, well, where's the car? He said, my friends pushed it home. It's in the garage. Got out there now? Yeah. He said, I'll meet you out there. You mean now? He says, yeah, let me get dressed. He said, would you believe it, mister? At 3:30 in the morning, my father's underneath the car helping me put the transmission back in. You know, I talked to this guy later. You know, and he communicated more in helping the kid put the transmission back in than he could have communicated by 20 dozen of the finest lectures. One more. You spend time with your job? Well, Brother Ernest, I'm a busy man. That's not the issue. By the way, your kid is not really hung up over your busyness. You know what he's hung up over? The fact that when you do have the time, you don't choose it to spend it with him. Well, what happens is, you know, we come to a conference like this, everybody gets shook up, you know, all underneath the table. Right. Thank you, Brother Ernest. Really appreciate you reminding me. You go home this afternoon and say, all right, Johnny, come on, play ball. Hurry up now, I don't have a lot of time to horse around. You know, Hendrick says I'm supposed to play ball with you. Come on, let's go. There are 101 places you'd rather be. You know where you might as well be? Any one of the 101. But let me give you a different orientation. Suppose you come home from work, your wife says, hey, hon, it'll be about 15, 20 minutes before dinner, and you say to your guy, hey, man, what would you like to do? He says, hey, Dad, can we play ball? Sure, man. Meet me outside. Get the ball, and you throw that thing around, you have a fantastic time. Pretty soon, Mom calls and says, man, buddy, that's the fastest 15 minutes I've spent today. We'll have to get back on that. Yeah, right, Dad. And as far as this kid is concerned, what do you say, world? And let me give you just a word, because we've got some parents of younger kids and parents of older kids, and it's important you know this. When your child is young, I'm talking about 2, 3, 4, 5, he needs a lot of little bits of time. Time like this. The kid's running across the floor, and you reach down, and you pick him up, and you toss him up in the air, and you catch him, and you lather him with kisses, and you put him down on the floor, and he never loses a step. But he gets a message. By the way, lady, that's why your child asks you what you think are stupid questions. Do you ever have your child ask you, Mommy, what's my name? Son, you are acting like your father again. If he is, his father is sheer brilliant. See, he's not asking for information. He's asking for attention. He's asking for the great big almighty adult to come all the way down here and look him straight in the eye and say, Billy! Zoom! And he takes off. But he's gotten a message. Now, when they move up into the teen years, then it's a whole new ball game. Now they don't need little slices of time. They need chunks of time. So that you say to a teenager, hey, buddy, I'm carving out a day for you. And there's nothing I'd rather do next Saturday than spend it with you. What would you like to do? And he says, hey, Dad, could we go fishing? Could we go skiing? Whatever your kid likes to do and whatever he wants to do, that's what you want to do. And you carve that whole time. I used to go fishing with my kids. It's actually a bad news item. I am the world's saddest fisherman. Right, Joe? Speak, Joe, for thy servant.
We didn't do too well.
That's an understatement. I kid you not. I can go down. I can look down. I can watch those sad fish just swimming around at lure, waving. I really think that's why they go in school. You know, I can't get near the thing. This guy said, man, it's guaranteed to work. Best thing in the market. Come back, how'd it work? Ah, great. I told you. How many fish you catch? You got to be kidding. No, but I agree, it's the greatest lure. You and I both agree. Well, all we got to do is to talk the fish into it. But you know, the interesting thing is, I have been on fishing trips where we swamp and didn't catch a fish. And that's quite beside the point. It's just that you chose to be there. You wanted to be there. That says world. Now, notice the relationship with it. See, who is it that spanks me? Who is it that keeps me from certain things? I'll tell you who it is. It's the guy that plays with me. It's the woman that listens to me. All of that trivial talk. She listens. She's fascinated. Why, it's the guy that fixes my tire, my car. Why, it's the lady who chooses to spend time with me. One gal said, would you believe it? My mom spent all day in a shopping deal. And I really think she enjoyed it. Just trying to help me buy a dress. Well, you see, that says world to a job. Now, my wife is a remarkable woman in many ways, but she has one problem. She doesn't appreciate our wrestling in the living room. You know, why any woman would take that approach, I don't know. But she used to throw us out. And she threw us out one day, and my younger son Bill and I were in a wrestling match. I don't do this anymore. I've gotten smart. But in those days, you know, when you could beat him. And we got ourselves in quite a Donnybrook. In fact, he got me in a hold, and I decided I was going to teach him how to break it. And so I pivoted, but I pivoted too far, too fast. You ever have this experience? And the moment you do it, you know, you try to take it back. Is this kid's going across the yard like a missile? You know, and all of a sudden, oh, no, man, we're going to have a concussion. They'll try me for child battering. This kid goes flying across the yard, bounces on the ground, says, boy, Dad, that was terrific. Do it again. Now, it's the same kid that you can go like this, and he dissolves in tears. Because it has nothing to do with force. It has everything to do with relationship. And to be perfectly honest with you, in terms of many children, the only time their parents ever give them attention is when they misbehave. Which may be one of the reasons why your child misbehaves. If he cannot get attention legitimately, he will stoop to illegitimate means. Now, let's take this truth and let's relate it to your experience. Word of God is transparently clear. The question is, how do I apply it? So I'd like to give you some negatives and some positives. Let me give you some negatives. There are two words I'm always careful never to use. Those words are always and never. And I'd like to suggest some things you ought always never use. Okay? Number one, don't use comparison of children with children. It's a favorite indoor sport. Now, Johnny, why aren't you good like Billy? One intelligent answer, I'm not Billy. You know, we got four children, all the same combination of genes, and no two of them alike. We couldn't discipline them alike. I couldn't motivate them alike. I have one kid. I think if I said to him, is that the best you could do? Man, he come right up out of the rocks. I got another one. I think if I said to him, is that the best you could do? That would be the last he would do. And again, as we mentioned last night, and as we'll see tomorrow, in our study of the 127th Psalm, we are forever looking for a packaged, patent medicine kind of approach to this task. That's lethal. The interesting thing is, this I have found is one of the major reasons why a child does not develop confidence. He is not treated as a person, as an individual with a particular set of needs. And besides, how unbiblical can you get? Every time you use this technique, you are teaching your child to keep his eyes on others. And that's highly devastating in the spiritual realm. Well, let me give you a second one. Don't make fun of weaknesses. Now, the male of the species is the master with the needle. You know, he has a finely developed sense of sarcasm. And he's usually had a good deal of experience with it. He's been working his wife over for years before the kids arrive. He's the guy that arrives home and says, "Well, what burn offering are we having for dinner tonight?" You know, and that makes a Betty Crocker every time. See, this is the guy, you know, who goes by his wife's dressing table while she's putting the makeup on, and he stops and says, "Well, that's an experiment in futility." You know, and man, does that ever develop a winner. You know, so by the time Junior arrives, he's got all kinds of expertise. Especially in areas of weakness. You have a child that's stuttering, gets hung up on his speech. It's very common, very normal process of development, especially if you have an older child who is very verbal and the second one comes along. We had a daughter who to this day is extremely communicative. And Bob comes along, you know, right behind her. And he's the little guy, you know, looking around kind of sensitive and so forth, you know. And people would come up and say, "Hi, son." And he'd look at me and say, "What's your name?" And Barb would say, "His name is Robert John Hendricks. And my name is Barbara Joan Hendricks." You know. So, you know, who needs to talk? He's got Aaron. And so the result is, you know, this kid starts to stutter. I think I got the classic illustration this at the seminary a few years ago. We got a dear student who came, felt called of God to preach. But the guy couldn't say one sentence without hopelessly getting hung up. You know, I began to look at this. In fact, I sent him to about five speech pathologists in the area, and independently, everyone said prognosis. They said, you know, humanly speaking, this is unsolvable. He will never speak. And he feels called of God to preach. And that's what you get paid for. And he can't say one sentence. You ever ask yourself, how do you produce this kind of a product? Well, this came out of a home of a father who had a PhD degree and of a mother who had two master's degrees and was a Rhodes Scholar. And of an older sister who had about 167 IQ, which for your information is slightly above average. And he weighed in as something of a dunce, about 162. And so when he started to stutter, this was a blow to his parents' pride. And every time he would stutter, they would stutter. In order to break the habit, they thought. Until finally they drove it in so deeply that to this day, this guy cannot say one sentence without getting hopelessly hung up. See, the problem, again, is that most of us are very sensitive about the product. You look at somebody like this and you say, "Oh, nice. You know, I never want to do that." But what you don't get sensitive about is examining the process. Roland and Chris and I and my wife were talking this morning. You know what the number one problem in counseling and seminary is? I'll tell you. Lack of confidence. Does that surprise you?
I spend most of my time. And mind you, all of our students are college and university graduates. Most of them have a B average or above. A lot of them are resplendently gifted. But they don't have any confidence. We had a guy come to see me. I had a guy come to see me not too long ago from an Ivy League school. This guy has about 172 IQ. I'm on the admissions committee, and when the references come through, we read all of them, and I'll never forget this reference from the senior professor at this university who said, I've been teaching here for 37 years, and in 37 years, I've never had a student in this young man's league. And I'm sorry that he's going to waste his talent in the ministry. Scratched his name across the bottom of the reference form. That's the kid I'm talking about. So he walks into my office. He says, well, Prof, I'm going to check it to you. I said, you what? You're going to check it to you. I said, you got to be kidding. No. He said, I've never been more serious. I said, you mean you're leaving? He said, that's right. I said, how come? He said, I really don't think I have it for the ministry. Well, you know, I had the hardest time to keep from roaring in the guy's face. I thought, man, I better not tell the rest of the students you don't have it. Or they'll all be headed for the registrar's office to resign. I said, tell me about your family. Well, he said, that's a bad scene. Well, I said, give me some details. What do you remember about your father? He said, that's worse. He said, would you believe it, Prof? I can never remember once in my life, my father saying to me, son, that was a good job. I'm proud of you. I used to come home with a 98, and he'd say, well, where are the other 2 points? His favorite name for me was Dummy. You ever get called Dummy by the most significant person in your life for 18 years? You know how you emerge? You tend to believe them. See, and it's really quite apart from the fact. It's very closely related to how he feels. And your child's self-image is in direct proportion to what you think of them and how you communicate that. And what we're saying here is you need to get off his back and get on his team. Well, I'll give you a third one. Don't use bribes. Now, there is some conflicting advice here, and so you're going to have to think your way through this. But I'll tell you, I've been watching this for a number of years, and I am overwhelmingly convinced that the parent who uses a bribery type of system is a person who is not solving a problem, he's creating one. And if you want to see it in the larger picture, just look at your country. And ask yourself objectively, what is a welfare state produced of? I think some of the saddest things I've seen across the country. I've seen in Alaska with Eskimos, who make from $25,000 to $30,000 a year in fishing. And shoot the whole thing at one crack and are on welfare the rest of the year. And a guy who's a leading anthropologist told me, he said, all of their skills are dying out because they have no initiative. We've whipped every ounce of it out of them. You know, one of the great things that I appreciate is that I came up in a home where we didn't have a whole lot. And I didn't have an intact family, but I had a father who taught me a great deal. He communicated nothing to me spiritually for one obvious reason. He had nothing to communicate. But, man, he communicated a lot in the realm of discipline. And the thing I appreciate most about my father is the fact that he taught me the sheer delight of industry. I can still remember him waking up in the morning. We used to do wall scraping during the Depression back in Philadelphia. I don't know if you've ever done wall scraping. That's quite an experience. We used to do it by steam. And boy, I mean, by the time you got to the end of the day, you knew you had had the steam bath. That was a rough way to make a living. But we used to get up in the morning, and the guy was actually seething with excitement.
about the opportunity of working another day. You know, I was doing some reading recently. I found a tribe out in the islands of the Pacific that has no way of communicating deprecation by telling a person to go to hell. They have a better way. Their expression of contempt is to say, "May you be banished to idleness the rest of your life." You know, when I read that thing leaped off the page and hit me right between the eyes. My father was very patriotic. He was a military man. He laid down stripes. I saw stars. And I can never remember once turning around and saying, "Boy, Dad, thanks a lot for that fresh evidence of your love." But you know, I rise up to call him blessed, because I spent all of my time with students who'd give their right arm if they had my discipline. They're much more gifted than I am. They're smarter than I am. They've got all kinds of potential, way beyond what I ever thought of having. They just can't get their act together, because it's the sheer process of discipline. And you don't get that with the 45 routine. You don't get that by saying, "Son, if you keep quiet in church, I'll give you a lollipop." Because you come to the place where he's not interested in the lollipop. You know what this is the product of? It's the product of people who say, "My job is to rear a good boy." No, that is not your job. We have some of the finest good boys you've ever seen at 42. See, your job is to rear a good man. A good man, a good woman, is a person who makes all of their own decisions. Where does that come from? I can remember getting in the car with my father. We were going out to West Philadelphia. He'd say to me, "Okay, son, here's the address. Find out how we're going to get there." And I looked that baby up, and I get the map out, and I chase the thing out. He said, "Okay, what route should we take?" And I carved the route out for him and say, "Yeah, but what time are we going?" "Well, let's see, we're going to be leaving here at 7. "Yeah, but what about the rush hour traffic?" "I see what you're saying, Dad. It's coming the wrong way. So we're going to have to take a detour." And his motto was, "Don't work harder, work smarter." We'd get out to the main line in one of these fabulous, you know, 15-20 room homes. He'd say, "Okay, buddy, we're going to scrape this thing. Which one should we start?" I said, "Well, Dad, why don't we start with this one up here?" "Yeah, but how are we going to do it?" "Well, we're going to do it by steam." "Well, which way does steam go?" "Well, steam rises." "Well, yeah, I see what you're saying, Dad. In other words, if we start down here, then by the time we get up there, the paper will already be loose. Because we're not going to work harder, we're going to work smarter." You know, Joe shared many things from his own life with his dad, and one of the thrilling things is to talk to students all the time. You know, who were the people that marked you? And then sometimes they're parents, and sometimes they're Sunday school teachers, youth workers, people in a school system, people who discipled them, all kinds of people. But in every case, it's very interesting to find the things that constituted the life-changing experiences. Sometimes it was one statement. Sometimes it was modeling something they saw this person do, and they say, "Hey." Because there are many times when you don't even think through what you do. You do what you do because that's what you've been exposed to. That's been your model. Let me give you one more. Don't be afraid to say no. You know, the hardest thing to get some parents to do is to say a two-letter word. No. And again, I go back to my dad. Because I remember many times when he looked me straight in the eye and said, "Son, you're not going. Period." And I didn't like it. In fact, I haven't found a whole lot of people who just were, you know, covered over with appreciation for somebody who said no until 10 years down the road. See, that's when you rise up and call this person blessed. Because, you know, they were the individual that built in the fences. that built in the control, that helped you to see that life is not made up by a process of doing anything you want when you want it. It's a process of respecting other people's rights, not just enjoying your own. Something we've lost in our society. And hopefully we're picking up in the church. The emphasis of the New Testament is not upon your rights. It's upon your responsibility. That's a supernatural life. It's a radical lifestyle. Many times when I work with the juvenile department, I get parents in, I say, well, why didn't you tell them no? Well, I was afraid. What were you afraid of? Well, I was afraid I'd lose him. Well, it looks to me like you've done a pretty good job of that, because we're still looking for him. And I often ask a person, what would you have told him had you told him no? And they give me an explanation, and they get to the end, and I say, I'm honest with you, my friend, I couldn't have expressed it any better. That's a beautiful. Why didn't you tell him? I don't know. See, my friends, a child is not looking for a perfect parent, but he is looking for an honest one. He's looking for a person who cares enough about him. When I first started to do some work with the juvenile department, I discovered I could get all of the kids paroled to me I wanted if I could find an adequate home. One of the cowboys came to me one day and he said, hey, Ollie, he said, can you get some of these kids to come out to our home? I said, man, I'll give you 34 of them. Well, he said, we better start with one. And so I came to this kid in a cell one day, and I said, hey, buddy, how would you like to go live with a cowboy? I said, you got to be kidding. No, I said, I'm not. You're not for real. Isn't that one of those lines? Well, I said, would you like to go with me and find out? Sure. So we got out there, and I introduced him, and this kid, is going, there he is. And he turned to me later and he said, I'm really going to stay here? I said, well, I didn't get the impression that you were really that interested. Oh, yeah. I said, well, we'll just try it out for a while. So he stays with him. Typical kid fashion. Kid gets out the front door, slams the screen door. My friend calls him back and says, hey, buddy, we don't have any rules in here, but, one of them is you don't slam the front door, okay? Yeah. He held out as long as he could. Bang! He says, hey, I don't think I'm coming through. He said, we don't slam the door, okay? I can give you a better impression of this thing. Well, he deliberately slammed it to see what would happen. And my friend picked the kid up, took him down behind the barn, and he gave him a lasting impression. The kid was reporting to me on parole, and I could tell when he came in, man, he wanted to talk about a lot of things. He had something he really wanted to find. Boy, he just slipped right across the top of my desk and said, hey, mister, I finally found somebody who loved me. I said, really? How come? He said, he whipped me. I've had experiences with kids that's fallen at my feet and begged me to whip them, to convince them I really cared that much. What a kid is looking for. He's looking for somebody who gives a darn. Somebody who says, man, this guy is for real. He's got something he's committed to. I may not even agree with it. But he sure believes. Well, let's come over on the positive side, because if we stick just with the negatives, you'll go out with a half-baked answer. So I want to give you some positive things. Number one, impart the expectancy of obedience. See, some of us never expect our kids to obey, and we're seldom disappointed. I built my kids a sandbox with. Oh, man, we nicknamed it the Abomination of Desolation. You've got to see it to appreciate the title. And put it right outside my window. I had a little study in my bedroom, and one day these kids are playing out there, and all of a sudden I hear, John! Window panes, move. Johnny doesn't. And Bill turned to him and said, hey, Billy, your mommy's calling you. He said, yeah, I know. She goes on about four or five times, and finally she cut loose. I mean, man, I have never heard a person yell, Johnny! And just as calmly as I'm standing here, old Johnny turns to Bill and says, "Bill, I gotta go now."
And I thought to myself, you know, Johnny's smarter than his mother. He's been down that road before. And he knows when she needs it.
You ever watch this in family? There's one person that, I mean, man, they froth at the mouth, you know. They climb the walls. They yell their head out. They pull their remaining hairs out.
What happened to me on this road?
You know, and nothing happened. And as another person never raises his voice, you know, just as calm, and it isn't a big scene every time. He just says, "Hey, buddy." And the kid comes. And people say, "Oh, well, some's got him and some ain't."
No, there is a clue underneath it. Can I give it to you? You know what it is? Respect.
Can I share a gripe with you? Just one? I mean, I got a number of them. My gripe is adults who interrupt me when I'm speaking to a child.
That fascinates me. Because that's the same adult who, if their kid interrupted them, would say, "Hey, how many times did I tell you not to interrupt me?"
See, they're about to beat the kid's two eyes into one. But they do the same. It's why many times, you know, when I'm talking to one of my little buddies and somebody interrupts me, I say, "Excuse me, sir, I'm talking to my friend." You know, it's interesting to watch the reaction. really throws them into a tizzy. See, because again, you know, working with delinquents, I had one guy come to me. I said, "Well, what's the problem?" "He saw that boy came through that door. And I said to him, 'Son, I told you not to come through that bedroom door. Have you ever come through again? You'll never live to tell the story.'" I said, "Well, you're coming through. I get the message." "So you mind if I ask you one question?" "Huh, no." "How many times you plow through his door?" I knew the answer. So you know what I call that? Hypocrisy. Phoning you. So if you don't want that kid to come through your door, then you don't go through his. If you don't want him to interrupt you, then don't interrupt him. You see, because eventually what you are doing is to communicate to a child, "I respect you." Very little interesting piece in an article. I think it's in one of the contemporary magazines, but it's the story of the Kennedys. And the interesting thing that came out of that little dialogue that was being shared, I think by Ted, I'm not sure, was the fact that every one of the Kennedy children said that their father never talked down to them and their mother never talked to them in baby talk. And I think he was quoting John, I'm not sure, it may have been John or Robert, by saying his father just blew his mind that he gave him an explanation that the kid knew was beyond him. But they communicated so much to him, "My father has confidence enough in my thinking that if necessary, I can sit down and figure it out." You ask yourself in light of that, how many times do you insult the intelligence of your kid? Rather than communicating this tremendous component of respect. Well said. Second, allow the child to express his viewpoint. Give him a hearing. I was teaching at the seminary. It was a Thursday. Thursday was my roughest day, often is, because I taught two or three classes. I had interviews and committee meetings, and we have a faculty meeting on Thursday. And Thursday night, I taught the wives class. You know, so by the time I got home about 8:30, boy, I had it. I was evangelically pooped. And I walk through the front door, and here are my two guys in action, clear case of homicide. You know, and so you go right into action, you discipline the older one, obviously, the responsible one. And after I get through, I go into the bedroom, and my delightful wife says to me, "Sweetheart, you missed." I said, "I missed." She said, "Yeah, let me tell you what happened before you came."
And, you know, it changes the whole picture. So you have to do what I think is the hardest thing for many a parent to do, and that is to apologize. You know, and I finally got it all together, and I went out, and old Bob was working on the dishes or something and whimpering a little bit, and I said to him, "Hey, Bob, boy, I really blew it. I'm sorry." I said, "I acted too soon. I didn't have all of the facts. That's bad." I said, "Will you forgive me?" Puts his arm around me and says, "Sure, Dad. That's okay. We all make mistakes." And I thought to myself, you better believe it. The question is, you know, how willing am I to admit that I blew it? Third, help your child plan a better course of action. You know, it's so easy to tell them, don't do that, than it is to say, hey, let me suggest something you can do. Do you ever have your kid ask you, "Mom, huh? I don't know what to do with myself." And you say, "Well, you just go get lost." I wish my wife had an opportunity to tell you, because our fourth kid, boy, was, you know, they call him hyperkinetic. I'd never heard of that before. That's a nice term. You know, which being interpreted means he's got three tigers in his tank. And boy, I tell you, I think I'm a reasonably creative person, but I have never busted my brain as much as in the process of trying to figure out how to keep that guy active. My wife and I used to stay up sometimes 11, 12 o'clock figuring what in the world are we going to do with him tomorrow. Because the interesting thing is, you see, what we try to do is to squelch all that stuff. You don't do that. You don't ask that stupid question. You can't keep quiet. So finally you get him quiet. Then he grows up. And you say to him, "Talk!" we don't talk yet. It's possible to whip every ounce of creativity. Your job is not to squelch his drive, his creativity. It's to channel it. And it takes some time on your part to sit down and think. Well, there's a fourth thing I'd like to suggest positively you can do. And that is, remember, discipline is a long-range process. And what you tend to do is to see your child's action in isolation rather than in relation. Let me illustrate. A lady came to my office some time ago. She was all shook up. I said, "What's the matter, man?" "Oh, my boy's a pervert." I said, "He's a pervert?" I said, "Well, you know, what evidence do you have of this?" "Well, he ran into the bathroom when our little girl was there undressing." I said, "How old is your boy?" "2. I said, "I got news for you, lady. Disgustingly normal." Fantastic curiosity. Maybe a creative genius in some time. But you see, what does the lady do? She sees one isolated experience, you know, carries it down to its logical conclusion. "Man, he's a voyeur." "You know, he's going to be a pervert." And I think what happens is that you lose your perspective in Ruth. You know, I think back upon my education, and it's very interesting. One of my favorite questions to ask my students is, "Tell me who was the best and the worst teacher you ever had." Finished this assignment a couple weeks ago. And if I got one paper, I got 20 papers saying, "Prof, I have no problem picking out the worst teacher. Got all kinds to choose from." But the problem is to find, you know, who's the best one. And it's interesting to see who these individuals are and how they write them up. Well, I can only remember two public school teachers that I ever had that made that much of an impression on me. One was my fifth grade teacher, Miss Simon. I will never forget her. And I'll clue you, she would never forget me. God bless her memory. She went to her reward. And she needed a reward. Boy, I used to give that woman fit.
Man, I used to tear that place apart. And she used to get so exasperated that she finally decided to bring a rope, and she tied me to my seat. Because the moment she'd go out of the room, I'd go into action. And she took my hands and tied them behind my back like this, around like this, down around the thing. Took mucilage paper, started around here, went all the way around the other side. She'd say, "Now, Howard, you will sit still and keep quiet." So what else do you do? Well, finally, I was graduated from Miss Simon's class for obvious reasons. And I went into my sixth grade class, taught by Miss Noe. 6 feet, 4 inches tall. I used to think if that dear woman had done nothing but just stand erect, she would have done something for you. And I went in and introduced myself to her, and she said, "Oh, Howard Hendricks." She said, "I heard a lot about you." And I thought, here we go, boy. Because the first thing Miss Simon said to me was along the same line. "I heard a lot about you. I understand you're the worst kid in this school." Well, what a challenge. Man, if I'm the worst one, I'm never going to show up number two. But she jarred me by saying, "But I don't believe a word of it." You know, my friends, I found the first person in my life that convinced me they believed him. And I'd never let that woman down. Man, I used to come early to class. I'd run her errands. I'd take special projects home. I just remember my father coming in one day and say, "Son, well, what in the world are you doing?" I said, "Man, I'm studying." "Studying? You feel all right?" You know, I mean, this was an impossible sight. Because that dear woman convinced me she believed in me. And I used to sit in her class working like crazy and occasionally look over at the door. There was a little pane of glass on the door, and framed in that thing was Miss Simon, my fifth grade teacher, who had just come to see the thing which was come to pass. You know, there he is, sitting clothed and in his right mind. You know, I've had some fascinating correspondence with Miss Noe. I used this illustration in my book. And I found she's living in Iowa. She is a born-again believer. She was married to a prominent surgeon in Philadelphia who walked out the front door one day and told her to hang it on her beak, and she was left with three boys to raise. And she had to go out and teach school. And in that crisis, she came to the Savior. I didn't know enough at the time to know what it was all about. I've been in correspondence with her son. Someday I'm going to write a book on Miss Noe. She's 86 years of age. For your information, there are people all over America, and you would be amazed if I just called the names of some of them, who will tell you the greatest influence in their life was Miss Noe. I've been asked over and over again, "Prof, what do you think is your greatest contribution at the seminary?" Well, sometimes I wonder. But I'll tell you, if there is any contribution, it's largely convincing my students I believe in you. I'm on your team. It's amazing how many kids come out of home, Christian home, where they never get the idea that their parents are on their team. Now let me ask you, when's the last time, you know, you really came through to your kid that you're on his team? You're the number one rooter. We're putting together this little book, Heaven Help the Home. My kids were home from college, graduate school, for Christmas. And we decided to pick their brains. And so I said to each of them, look, give me some things that you remember from your family. And make them specific. And I remember asking Bill one day, I said, "Hey, Bill, well, what do you remember most about Mom?" Well, he said, "Lots of things." Well, I said, give me a couple specifics. He said, "Well, let me think about it." So he thought about it, finally came up with one. He said, "Hey, Dad, I got one." He said, "You remember when I played for St. Mark's in eighth grade?" I said, "Man, I've never forgotten it." "Yeah," he said, "I can understand. It was a disaster season." But he said, "It was quite an experience." He said, I remember one day we were playing St. Joseph. It was raining cats and I mean the field was one massive mud puddle. And he said, we were losing 60-something to nothing at the half. He said, in fact, we hadn't even made one first down. And he said, we came out of the huddle, and he fought a quarterback called Seth. He said, I looked over in the stand, and there were four people, one of whom was Mom, sitting there with her hair. And just then, a quarterback called Seth. And as I put my hand down, I heard this voice that I recognized as Mom saying, go get him, Willie! Did you hear what he said? Because it's very important that you hear that. See, I try to ask myself, you know, what would my kids remember? You know, I mean, I'd like to think that they would remember, you know, my sermon. They don't remember them. In fact, I don't remember them. Now, you think that they would be impressed that I'm a seminary professor, wouldn't you? You wouldn't? Neither are they. Remember Bill coming home one day and said, hey, Dad, when are you going to get a new job? Why, what's the matter? Don't you like my job? No, how come? Oh, I said, I can't explain to anybody where you work. They all think you work in a cemetery. And sometimes I think I do. My kids aren't impressed with all of the religious routine in which I'm engaged. Come out here to talk to you. They really aren't. Neither are yours. They're only impressed by the reality of Jesus Christ in your life. And that's got to come through at a level that they can understand. Let's pray. Father, this is a beautiful day. It's so much like you. Reminds us so much of your faithfulness because you send the rain and the sunshine on the just and the unjust alike. It's not because we've been so good. You haven't rewarded us on a performance basis, but just because of the characteristic of yourself. And we realize that you are our Father, and you are disciplining and discipling us. And we pray that we may learn well in your school from your pattern, and then that we may communicate that to our own children. Some of us, our Father, are parents whose children are already grown and gone, and we have a great influence as grandparents in some cases, or perhaps in the life of others. Maybe some who came from homes where they never knew what real discipline was. Someone who loved them enough to care. So we pray that you will open our eyes to see what we can do to build into the life of others those characteristics that you have graciously built into our own life and that you want to use us as your instruments to contribute to others. So thank you for what you're going to do because we've met in your name and for your glory. Because we ask it in Christ's name.